The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. Visit sewersofparis.com and click Support the Show on Patreon to join the folks who make the show possible. Hello and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. The topic this week is horror films, gay monsters, and sissies and sluts. My guest this week is Lee Gambin, who always knew he had a place in the world of cinema. An obsessive collector of VHS tapes as a kid, he grew up to host raucous film screenings and to write extensively about his great love, classic film, and particularly horror. Despite his favorite films being full of frights, he's never found them scary. Instead, he's embraced the comforting power of monsters and gore. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, I want to let you know about a whole bunch of live shows that I'm hosting in March. You've probably heard me mention my live comedy show and podcast, Queens of Adventure, which features drag queens playing Dungeons and Dragons. We just announced an upcoming live show at Rebar in Seattle on March 12th, another at Emerald City Comic Con on March 13th, then two in Portland at the Siren Theater on March 18th and 19th, and then more shows at Oasis in San Francisco on March 25th and 29th. Our Queens of Adventure live shows are a ton of fun, basically a big queer improvised comedy story powered by unpredictable dice rolls and a rowdy audience. Tickets are now on sale at queensofadventure.com. I hope to see you at those shows. Now, here's Lee. Well, this week I'm speaking with writer and historian Lee Gambin. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I love your work, so I appreciate this.
Oh, awesome. I really appreciate hearing that. What is the entertainment that changed your life?
I guess film. I grew up pretty much just being obsessed with film and watching a whole bunch of stuff. So mainly classic cinema stuff, classic films, and definitely horror stuff would be the sort of biggest, the biggest impact in my childhood. But varied horror stuff, so from, your classic, 30s and 40s stuff all the way through to your 80s slasher films, musicals, westerns, noir, whatever it was. I was just a big, addict to film and loved all kinds of movies. Mm-hmm. And then secondly to that would probably be television, so lots of sitcoms and dramas and a whole bunch of stuff that was, on television when I was growing up in the 80s.
Were there particular movies that you found yourself going back to over and over?
Loads. And it would, like I said, it would vary from, rewatching all the Universal monster movies over and over again to, films like King Kong, all the way through to things like The Wizard of Oz and, Singing in the Rain and all this stuff. There was a whole bunch of things I loved. I remember buying my first VHS that I bought. There was a company called CEL, and they did these really nice slipcase covers for films. And I remember I was allowed to buy two videos when we first got a video player, VHS player. And the two I chose were Chomps, which is the Don Chaffee film about the robot dog. And the other film was The Dark Crystal, the Jim Henson, Frank Oz film. And they were the first two films I bought, I remember buying. And I think the first films I taped on television were Ma and Pa Kettle films and Shirley Temple films and Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin films, because they were always on midday. Like, they were like these beautiful matinees that they'd air here in Australia during that period, the early 80s. So I taped them and I became obsessive with collecting from a very early age. I remember becoming obsessive with things like Creature from the Black Lagoon and things like Jaws and films that sort of had an ecological bent to them as far as horror goes. So I became like someone who really obsessed with animal horror movies or animal-centric horror movies. So I remember scouting all the TV guides and finding what would be airing like late at night. And I remember coming across in grade two, I remember The Pack from 1977, and it had no description about it. And I was like looking at it going, The Pack, 1977, I'm thinking it's about killer dogs. And so I remember being a kid and having to research it. And back then, obviously, you're just going through books, and I found it and I go, yep, totally, staying up for this. I remember it aired Channel 9, 2 a.m. Here in Melbourne, and I was a kid and I couldn't get up for the next morning for school. So I knew already, okay, movies were much more important to me than, school. But yeah, there were lots of films that I went back and forth to and would just obsess over. I remember being really obsessed with The Exorcist and, as a child, drawing Reagan over and over again and trying to perfect the drawing of her. And I remember things like Salem's Lot leaving a massive impact, The Howling, the moments in in childhood where you sort of were really kind of influenced, or you knew that certain films were far more important than others. And there was a lot of them though for me. So I remember seeing you know, something like M for the first time as a kid, or something like, you know, Nosferatu. So these, you know, really old, great films, and just that them leaving such an impression. And then certain stuff that was, you know, promoted on TV over and over again. I remember the promos for things like The Exorcist, and it was just so, you know, enticing back then, like the way they packaged these things. And then the cinema stuff, so getting to see all the Disney revivals, because in the early 80s here, they did all these beautiful revivals of things like Song of the South and Dumbo and Sleeping Beauty and Snow White, etc. And I would go to them, and that was really a beautiful experience as a kid, remembering that.
You mentioned a lot of horror films in there. Did you like being scared as a kid?
For me, it was never about being scared. I remember my mum would always be asked by like friends or something, oh, doesn't Lee get scared? And she goes, no. You know, he really loves it and like sort of really embraces the monster and really appreciates the special effects and the gore and the makeup designs and stuff. So for me, it was always a comfort thing. Horror movies were like really comforting. There was never any kind of fear. I remember there's moments in certain films that scared me. I remember being a kid, and especially sort of Catholic or Christian-based horror movies always scared me, having kind of a weird Catholic background, being Maltese and whatever. But films like Amityville 2, The Possession, where Sonny Montali gets possessed and he walks around the house gunning down his family. Remember that leaving kind of an impression as far as me being scared, quote unquote. But I remember like certain elements of films sort of leaving me unnerved, but I never felt terrified or scared by these films. I feel like a lot of melodramas that I was watching as a kid were more sort of confronting. I remember seeing Peyton Place as a kid and like understanding, you know, that whole rape sequence, and kind of understanding it and not really understanding it as a kid. Like, I think I saw that at age 7 or 8. And then kind of going, whoa, this is really heavy stuff in this really picturesque, beautiful film. So I remember even at an early age, that even like really gorgeous, you know, beautifully lit, lovely, you know, Douglas Sirk style melodramas had such darkness, and I really embraced that. So, and also I was really obsessed with the non-monster stuff in horror, like the stuff where it was just people, you know, character stuff, like build-up stuff and inter-character relations and character development. I remember seeing Carrie for the first time as a kid, and for some reason, I don't know why, I was up really close to the television watching it, and it was turned down quite low. Maybe I wasn't allowed to watch it, or people were asleep in the house, but I remember that vividly and just being obsessed with Carrie, and then sort of really relating to the character of Carrie. And so all the sort of the quote-unquote supernatural horror stuff was great, but for me it was like this relationship you had with a mother and the religious oppression and just this poor kid who gets terrorized throughout the thing and then finally gets to, you know, lash out. So all that stuff kind of was part and parcel in what I related to or loved from horror. But I've never sort of, I'm one of those people who never really has to see myself or reflections of myself in art. I know a lot of people do. I just don't. So when I hear people sort of, you know, talking about how they could relate to certain characters and stuff like that, I just never understood that. It's not my bag. I just like good storytelling. So as far as to answer your question about being scared of horror, more so 95% of the time it was a comfort thing. But then, of course, that, like I said, there were elements like, you know, every time, you know, Father Karras goes into Reagan's bedroom and that build-up of the opening of the door and seeing this friggin' incredible makeup design from Dick Smith on Linda Blair's face, that definitely gave me chills and was scary, and still to this day, you know, scares me, I guess, in that sense. But it's such a well-loved film of mine that I know it so in and out. Like, I know it so well, like the back of my hand. So it's kind of like a comfort thing. It's like a, I don't know, a little sister or something. So I don't know. So I think with horror, it's always been, yeah, just really kind of comforting and yeah, fun.
It's so interesting to hear you describe horror as comforting. I wonder what people thought of you as a little kid who had a VHS collection and was like obsessed with these old movies that were coming on at like 2 in the morning. Like, did people think that was weird, or were they into it?
Yeah, I think some people probably thought it was weird. Some people thought it wasn't. There was thankfully I had cousins and friends who loved the same stuff. So I feel for kids who are kind of on their own sort of you know, finding all this stuff on their own and, you know, not being able to share it. But I remember distinctly there was a moment where I thought, you know what, this is actually my life. This is going to be my world. And for everyone else around me, who, for most of the people around me who probably see it as kind of more like, you know, a hobby or less important, you know, I can see that distinction. And I remember there was an evening where, and I talk about this in something, and it may be another podcast, but I think I wrote about it as well, where Channel 7, one of the networks here, had the rights to all the Paramount product. And they screened Grease, the film, obviously, from 78, with ONJ and Travolta. But after it, they screened Bug, a William Castle-produced film from 1975, which was starred Bradford Dillman and Paddy McCormack pops up in it. And it was about killer bugs, these radioactive bugs, these cockroaches. And I remember seeing the promo for that, like, just during the prom sequence, I think, or the dance sequence in Grease. And I go, okay, nah, I'm staying up for that as well. So me and my cousins watched all of Grease. And then they all went to bed. They were like, nah, we're not staying up for Bug. And I remember watching Bug on my own in this, you know, in the lovely lounge rooms. You know, had very comfortable background, I did. I'm not going to lie. Very suburban. And just watching this film and being like, being blown away and loving it. Because it sort of turned into this weird character piece where Bradford Dillman's getting, you know, having a sort of mental and emotional breakdown because he's dealing with these bugs. But I remember that time going, okay, this is different for other people. So my love and obsession and passion for film is going to be different to, you know, a quote unquote normal people. That's, I guess, a good sort of anecdote to share about that, to answer that question. But I remember, like, I feel like later, I think when you get into your sort of teens, especially early teens, people kind of, you know, kids want to sort of just navigate their worlds, and things like loving old movies or classic TV shows or classic cartoons is probably looked at more weirdly then. And then when you get older, it's all cool again, or, you know, it's accepted or whatever. So it's very interesting, that kind of weird arc when you're a fan, and then also when you want to become a scholar of this stuff. You know, then possibly people treat it seriously. But it's interesting, even now as adults, I'm sure you get it as well. There's certain people who go, oh, who cares about that stuff? Well, you should, you know. And I love what, you know, people like us do, where we kind of celebrate all this classic stuff and bring it to the attention of a lot of people who probably don't even know it. And then they kind of go, oh, hell, wow, this is awesome. Like, you know, Archie Bunker was doing this way before, you know, Homer Simpson was. So that kind of thing is really cool, just to champion classic stuff, to bring it to the fore. And so people respect this awesome past of arts. And so that's my job here. That's what I'm put on earth, I guess, for, to sort of do that kind of thing and, you know, make sure people have an appreciation and love for classic film, all film and classic TV, and understand the diversity in genre even in itself. So when people talk about horror and they're kind of unenlightened or don't really know much about horror, they always think of violence on screen. And it's like, it's a lot more than that. You know, it's a genre that boasts so many subdivisions, so many subgenres. So, you know, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane is nothing like, you know, The Prowler. And, you know, Rosemary's Baby is nothing like Halloween 2. So there's that kind of thing where you have to throw that back to people. So I think that's what makes people think people who love stuff are weird. I think people who just don't understand people's passions or interests or, you know, just genuine love or scholarship on certain things are people who don't really understand what they genuinely like either. You know, I always make a joke, there's so many people who have these huge, massive, you know, amazing, you know, really expensive televisions, but they don't watch anything on it. You know, they don't have any films that they own, and they don't care. It's just this ornament. So I don't understand that as well. And I think a lot of people don't generally, a lot of people, sadly, don't see film as an art form. And I think that's a tragedy. But they'll go and spend their, you know, however much it is in the States at the moment. But here it's like $20 to see some, you know, shitty brand new blockbuster, you know, with, you know, Thor running around. So I don't know. It's an interesting thing where people sort of don't really respect or care about film, but then still see it as a hobbyist thing or just take it for granted.
Were you aware when you were a kid that you said that you were kind of put on this earth to champion old films and show people the culture that they could enjoy? Did you recognize that? Like, did you try to bring the stuff that you love to other people when you were young?
Yeah, all the time. All the friggin' time. And, like, I'd have a video on and stuff, and I'd have friends over or whatever and go, you have to see this. And I'd always do this thing, I'm sure there's other kids who did it, where you'd look behind, like, turn around and see if they were still watching or paying attention or their reaction to whatever it was. So I did it all the time. And it was, for me, it was kind of like trying to share an experience or just trying to basically promote the idea of how good this film was or how good I felt this film was. So absolutely. And then it was only until, oh God, in my... Like, it took ages for me to be confident in doing things like writing and whatever. But I used to write all the time as a kid and hide it like a dog burying their bones. Like, I'd just write all this stuff and just hide it. And eventually, though, when I got into my, like, early 20s, I started a zine and then started to do writing here and there and then was really obsessive with film analysis. So that's where, I don't know if you're going to lead into a question about that stuff, but that's when I started to read a lot of books about film, and I loved critical stuff. I loved all the production history stuff a lot, but I really loved, you know, critics and what they thought of films, and I used to get really angry if certain critics, so I did generally respect and like certain films I loved. So all this sort of stuff, and that sort of started to build. But yeah, to answer your question, absolutely, all the time. So as a, yeah, always like, you know, oh, you got to see this film. If you loved this one, you got to watch this one. You know, this is awesome, blah, blah, blah. And I remember like, even like, for instance, having to sort of, one of my friends was into the Dino De Laurentiis King Kong. And I was like, oh no, you got to see, you know, the original King Kong as well. So having to show them that kind of thing. It was constantly that kind of thing as well. And, you know, certainly when a lot later, like say, for instance, in the early 90s, when there was like, you know, this renaissance of movie monster films coming out with Coppola doing Dracula, etc. I'd always tell friends, okay, yeah, cool, it does its thing, but go and watch the Lugosi and go and watch all the, you know, the Universal ones and then the Hammer films, etc. And you'll see, like, where this also comes from, you know, so that kind of thing. But a lot of people, they were, like, you know, I was pretty lucky. A lot of people kind of appreciated it, but a lot of people just didn't. And it's weird, even now, like... it's more so I'm like constantly going, oh, you need to see this, because I feel like there's a sad I joke about it all the time, but it's really friggin' frustrating. There's this weird mentality with people that they only kind of like about 10 films and they won't see anything else, and yet they'll go and see new shit, and it's like, why aren't you... Yeah, cool, we all know that these 10 films you love are great, but there's more stuff. There's like a wealth of amazing stuff from the past. So I just find that frustrating, especially when these people think they love films. So I don't know, it's just, I don't know, it's the curse of, you know, being someone who loves movies so much, I guess.
This sounds very solitary, like you're doing all this scholarship and watching the movies and occasionally bringing people in and showing them off to people. Did you find a community of people, like a community that was more focused on film rather than just, I'm going to show my friends and maybe they'll like it and maybe not?
Sure. Yeah, but way later, it was either as kids, it was like, you know, I was lucky to have really great cousins. And some cool good friends at primary school, I guess, and we'd talk about movies and that sort of stuff. But it was really, if you narrow it down, the actual film community that I found came way, way later. It was like, late 20s and early, all my 30s, absolutely. And now there's a really solid film community, and it's local and it's international. So, yeah, and I think when you mention solitary crafts, writing is most certainly one of them. You know, fine artists are very solitary. Anyone who doesn't do any collaborative work. But then I remember, like, you know, doing collaborations as well. Like, I wrote a musical with a friend and, you know, played in bands and whatever. So that was collaborative and that was cool. And I'd love to do that kind of thing again. Not the band thing, but definitely create a theatre work with people again. Ran a shock theatre company and did all that stuff. But I think writing.
Can you tell me about running a theatre company?
Yeah, sure. So basically what happened was in my 20s, is it my, fuck, I'm trying to figure out my line, my life, my line, you know, the line of Lee Gambit. But yeah, basically there was a whole period where a bunch of us would always, you know, good friends of mine would always go to this place, a pub called the Tote Hotel in Melbourne, just a rock and roll bar. And we were kind of, you know, ingrained in that culture, the punk culture, because in Melbourne, the live music scene is massively healthy, like it's really strong. And we were just sort of, you know, always there and drinking and hanging out and talking film and talking bands and seeing stuff. And then I sort of saw this sort of trend in music where a lot of the bands playing claimed to be really kind of punk and out there and whatever. And I was like, yeah, it's all pretty much mainly, you know, white guys just playing. There's women there as well, but it's just very safe and boring. So I decided to, me and my friend Cara Mitchell, decided to run a theatre company called Sissies and Sluts, which was basically like a kind of like John Waters meets Russ Meyer meets the Cockettes meets Melodrama. And we did these really kind of nasty, confronting punk shows, which, you know, had all this stuff in there, was, you know, really taboo subject matter and you know, kind of confronting and punk and offensive and stuff. And people started to really like it. So it was a response to things becoming safe in the punk world. So we did these shows and we did like heaps. I think we did things for 10 years and we just did them at pubs. So we just did them in bars. So they were never at like legitimate theatres. They were always like, you know, really punk sort of, you know, early John Waters sort of style, you know. So we did this kind of thing.
What were these shows like? What were they about? What did people see, like, in the show itself?
Yeah, most of it came from the dialogue. So most of it was just, you know, confronting dialogue where people were like, you know, oh my God, they just said that, really? And then we'd have, like, you know, there was a sequence where one of the girls who just had a baby would be breastfeeding someone on stage. Then we had, you know, gore effects. But primarily it was... a lot of it was to do with the content and the nature of the dialogue, which I wrote. I wrote all the scripts. And I was very, very, very strict with the scripts. I never let my cast being my friends, you know, divert from the script. They had to go by line by line. They were very, you know, much given their lines and they had to do it. And there was a rhythm to it and just sort of the use of wordplay and just, you know, repetition and all these sort of traits that I always found funny as a kid, and they were all in, you know, thrown into this mix. And it sort of died when I got bored doing it, really, and it got a bit tricky to do. And I was like, I'm actually doing too much of this, and it's sort of detracting from other work. So it's interesting, when Sissies and Sluts sort of stopped, that's when I got a really good job working with Fangoria. So it was kind of like this really nice passing of the baton, where I could move on. So it was really interesting. But, you know, I love it and I miss it. But this culture now, like where everyone's, you know, kind of, you know, obsessed with kind of being PC. And, you know, it's a complex term anyway, blah, blah, blah. But I don't want to get into that too much. But these shows would never work now. They'd be like absolute drama now, like, you know, to do them, even though they were all satirical. Like, people just have this sort of sensitivity now, I think. But they were fun. They were fun to do, and people were genuinely shocked. But then people really loved it and just really loved the intelligence of them, I think. And it was great to see, because I was loving having girls up on stage, you know, spewing out this vile stuff and being allowed to be so expressive and nasty and, you know, glamorous as well and whatever. So it was cool to have that platform. And it was sort of confronting. I remember our first show, a bunch of guys, I don't know, in their 20s, 30s, walked out. Like, one of the girls had one of her boobs out, hanging out, and, like, just sort of screaming about rape or whatever. And they just couldn't cope when they left, you know. So I was like, oh, this is good. It's like, you know, making people, you know, scared, yeah. Scaring people, yeah.
It sounds like, well, you said that, like, it would never fly today, but it sounds like the whole point of it was to present people with something that was going to confront them and challenge an audience. So I don't know, like, the more sensitive an audience gets, it seems like the more successful the piece would be.
Ah, absolutely. Well, you speak my language. Absolutely. It's to point out this so the characters that I'd write would be, you know, either, you know, completely socially fucked up or completely, you know, offensive to everyone and everything. So it would sort of put the mirror back on the audience. It's like, oh, hang on, maybe I do have racism inbuilt in me, or ageism, or homophobia, or sexism, or whatever it is. So these characters would sort of reflect that. So it's kind of like how, you know, we both love All in the Family, how All in the Family opened with that disclaimer in the first few episodes, where it's to point out people's prejudices. And I think that's what we were doing, even though we were doing it primarily to entertain and shock. Subliminally, what's going on is causing an audience to go, oh shit, I actually know a person like that, or there's those feelings rampant in this world, and you know, this show, this insane, you know, crazy thing that's so otherworldly is actually forcing me to look at that.
What you're describing sounds very queer, in like more of an academic way of using the word queer, of like, I'm going to break some rules and I'm going to do things differently. Was that something that you were aware of at the time?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, like queer culture.
Well, you called it sissies and sluts, so.
Yeah. The reason I did that is because I always loved the sissy characters in films. Okay, and I know that you do as well. So that whole wonderful period of those sort of sissy faggot characters that popped up in films like, you know, all those beautiful backstage musicals with Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire, and they were always, you know, these kind of secondary characters who helped the main principal characters and fluttered about, and, you know, all this stuff was wonderful. And the slut angle was the idea of women who were, you know, the hardened sexual sex pot. You know, generally the chorus girl who, you know, chain smoked and talked about men, and they were kind of monsters as well. So these kind of two characters who were sort of alien, you know, not the ideal woman and not the ideal man, but these sort of complicated, really interesting stock characters that I loved. So I bought that as the title of the show. And you know, the cast were a mixed bag of people all the time. And so the queer politic, or the queer sort of thing, is, I guess, the whole, the idea of mixing up gender. We did have men playing women, but I never really wanted to push that. Because I love women playing women. Like, I'm really pro that. So I never sort of wanted to do that. There was a few shows where guys did play women, but it was generally women playing women. And for the most part, the cast would mostly be girls and women. So that was the kind of, I guess the queer thing would be just mixing up the whole idea of social norms and gender norms. But yeah, queer, like camp and all that sort of terms, are really, really complicated, I think, and they get overused, and they kind of have different meaning and a different dimension every time we rephrase them or rethink them or rework them. So I think as far as like sissies and sluts, where it comes from, was basically shock value. And to sort of embrace everyone and everyone's weirdness. And then also to sort of do a big up yours to those who kind of didn't accept weirdness, whatever their, you know, sexuality or gender is. So I think that's the kind of thing as well. And it was also, you know, all of our audience was generally, just a sort of counterculture punk sort of rock and roll folk. And they came from all aspects of the world, you know, of the social sphere. So it was cool. It was fun. It was a good 10 years of good fun. But I mean, you know, there's seldom any kind of write up on it now. Even if you look up online, there's one great review from someone who said that watching one of our shows felt like a friend vomiting on his shoes for like an hour and a half. I thought that was really nice. So this whole idea of, you know, people just didn't understand us is fine. Melbourne has this kind of quote-unquote good taste thing. I felt the theatre world was not at all helpful with Sissies and Sluts, whereas the music scene was. So it was really interesting to sort of see that. And then, you know, there were people who started to do shows very similar to us. You know, and I was like, oh, yeah. So, you know, things kind of start trends. But, yeah, and it was always like a respect thing as well. I was always like, if you liked our shows, you should research things like The Coquettes and, you know, the Theatre of the Absurd and also just straight theatre, like normal plays and stuff. Because, you know, I did a show where I had a lot of influence from things like Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, Jimmy Dean, or, you know, William Ng plays like Picnic or The Dark at the Top of the Stairs, and I'd have all this sort of stuff intertwined. So it looked, you know, so it presented itself like this sort of, you know, classic American theatre stuff, you know, and it was always American accents. It was always, you know, it was never, we never, like, I remember one girl in the company going, why do we have to do American accents all the time? And I go, because I never fucking grew up on Australian plays. So that kind of thing, you know, so we did all that sort of stuff, and it was fun. It was good fun.
You know, what you're saying reminds me of, I think it's a John Waters quote where he says something like, in order to do bad taste right, you must first have very good taste in order to know what makes good bad taste.
Yeah, that's a really good quote.
I am curious, you described having like that community of people who like the same kind of culture that you did, and doing the stuff that was to varying degrees queer, depending on how you want to use that word. Did you feel as though you had a community, like what did you feel was your place amongst a queer community, if at all?
I'd never thought of it. And I think, for the most part, this, quote unquote, straight world was more fun. Because for the most part, just, growing up, it was mostly the, straight people who loved the same stuff. For the most part, it was mainly, you know, a very straight world, for sake of a better word. You know, it was, straight people, gay people, black people, white, they should be able to create and write and do whatever they want. And so what I see as far as community goes is what people love and what they find in common grounds in. And I think that's genuine community. So when, like, you know, say, for instance, when you talk about something like Cinemaniacs, which is the film group that I program, that has built into such an amazing, beautiful, thriving community of a mixed bag of people. I'm trying to push for more elderly folk to come to screenings. Like, I'd love that. And my programming, you know, is so eclectic that it will attract a whole bunch of different people. But it's very, very mixed bag. And that I see as an absolute community. So it's not like, you know, a feminist community or a, you know, indigenous community or whatever. It's film community.
Do you ever feel an impulse to, you mentioned that it might have seemed as though queer people might not feel welcome or at least not recognize that they had a place where they could appreciate the kind of culture that you were into. Did you feel like an impulse to be like, hey, other, you know, other gay people out there, you can come into this world and this can be more accessible than you realized before?
Sure. I think the sad truth is a lot of, a lot of gay boys, gay men, probably are on the back foot anyway. And that's sad because, you know, they've had this struggle and, you know, there's that whole thing of, you know, straight people will never understand the plight of a gay person the same way a man will never feel the same way as a woman, and a white person will never feel the same plight as a black person, etc. And that's truth. But I think what also happens is what happens to a lot of gay guys is that they kind of fall into what their supposed culture is supposed to dictate to them, or their subculture. Therefore, horror movies, science fiction, monster movies, slasher movies, cultures that aren't sort of, you know, quote-unquote gay, are sort of left on the sidelines, and what they kind of are sort of geared in towards having to sort of appreciate is stuff that they probably don't care about, you know, gay bars and, you know, all that kind of world is probably not their own thing. So I just think that's something that's imprinted on a culture that is weird, because it's a culture that's sort of drummed into the psyche of people who are just gay. Like, that's their sexuality should just be one aspect to them. So I think that's an aspect to it. And also I think, for me to sort of, I just love anyone who loves good shit. Like, if you care about cool stuff, yeah, come along for the ride. You know, and I will absolutely try and convert people regardless of, you know, gender or sexuality. I'm like, you just need to love everything that's cool, because then the world would just be better. So it's that kind of thing. I think I find when I did my musicals book, the 70s movie musicals book, that I thought, okay, musicals have this kind of unspoken connection to gay men for some reason. But the biggest sales for that, the biggest quota, was straight people, once again. And I think maybe it's because of the decade being the 70s, who knows, but it's that's the other thing as well. You know, you can never assume things either. So, and then I found the Eco Horror book that I did, the first book, had a massive following among, I guess, gay men in their 50s who were kind of like bear subculture. They just ate it up. They loved all these eco horror movies. I'm like, this is friggin' awesome. Cool. So, you know, you can never sort of guess. And people just love different things. We did a Hagsploitation film festival where we screened things like Whatever Happened to Baby Jane and Straitjacket stuff. And for the most part, the audience was straight women. So, you know, it was like, cool, that's fantastic. Who doesn't matter? That's awesome. But I was expecting a whole cavalcade of, you know, drag queens and gay men. But not really. They didn't turn up. And it was like, this is interesting because it's kind of... I like that fact because it's not sort of, you know, limited. And then having a whole bunch of queer dudes coming to something like, what really brought them in one night? It was a whole lot. Oh, maybe it was like Return to Oz or something, which I guess has that kind of, you know, cult following among gay men. But it was just cool to sort of see the diversity in audience. I just like people loving good stuff, I guess. I never sort of pinpoint, you know, where they're coming from. But yeah, to sort of go back to your question, as far as me trying to include everyone, that's all I do. I get really exhausted from doing it. Even just socially, like, you know, with a bunch of people, I make sure that everyone around me at the table has a voice and has fun and is embraced and loved. Because I think that's how you build community, regardless of being straight or gay or whatever.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned that your emphasis on when it comes to building community is a shared interest in something. And I guess it's not exactly cultural, but I mean, you can't say that like gay men do have like for whatever entertainment they might like, they have a shared interest in each other and in like specifically like dating and having sex and relationships with each other. So I guess there's sort of a community that comes out of that mutual interest. But I suppose like what you're saying is that that doesn't necessarily extend to cultural interest, although it seems like it would. Like you were saying, like a book about musicals, you would expect to appeal to a queer audience. The same thing with the kind of campy movies that you're talking about.
Sure. I remember there's a really beautiful documentary all about Vito Russo. I'm sure you've seen it by Jeffrey Schwartz. And there's a great sequence in that where he actually introduced classic movies, whether they be musicals or women in prison films or whatever it was. And he'd have them screened at gay saunas, very similar to kind of like the continental bars. And the whole audience was pretty much gay men. There might have been some women in there as well, but generally a whole bunch of gay men. And they loved these movies and reacted to the movies in a very similar way. And this is like in the 60s and 70s, I guess, or very early 70s, and that the crossover. But it's interesting to hear that. But now I just think it's very different. I think like things like queer film festivals, you know, you can have really great programmers who make it really diverse and interesting. But I think I just find... I don't know. I'm all for individualism. So the idea that, you know, this person is this person and everything else that falls into who that makes them up, what makes them who they are, or their, you know, their makeup is secondary to who they are as a person. And I know that sounds a bit wanky or whatever, but I think it's true because I think the overuse of community, the term, is something that's a bit detrimental to individualism, and I'm pro that. And you're right, the whole idea of a... Well, I mean, gay bars are just... I just think they're sort of distinctly set up, you know, to cut out the drama of is he or isn't he or isn't she. But they're also kind of a response to homophobia as well because, you know, now we have places where straight and gays are just mixed in together, and that's great. But if you're there to pick up, you want to cut out that middleman of having to guess or assume or not assume. So I think that's different. That's kind of, you know, just I guess gay bars and stuff are either meat markets or a place just to hang out. You know, thank God Vito Russo did it back in the day. But, you know, even if you think of things like the Continental Bars, you know, had amazing musicians playing there, like the New York Dolls or Bette Midler and stuff like that, they were still ultimately a gay pickup place for dudes to, you know, fuck each other. So I think that's interesting. I think that's a really interesting topic of conversation, the idea of bringing cultural things into a place that's generally made for social get-togethers and cruising.
Something that I do think that all this horror that you've been mentioning has in common, maybe my perception here is wrong, is that there's often a very sexual component to the gaze or to the, you know, visceral reaction that you might have to what you're seeing on the screen. And I'm curious if that's been your experience or your observation as well, that a person's interest, the audience's interest, particularly their sexuality, can affect like who they sympathize with or who they're looking at, or who they regard as a villain.
It's a flawed book, Carol Clover's book, Men, Women, and Chainsaws. It's flawed because she kind of writes about the movies at arm's length. And I don't really like that kind of thing. Like, you know, people kind of speak, you know, that the films are so bad or whatever. So they have this kind of detachment to the films. I like people who really love the films, or, you know, if they don't love the films, there's a reason as to why. But her book is incredibly important. And it's all about gender in the modern horror film, which quote unquote would be the slasher film, I guess, or AKA the slasher film. So the big boom of slasher movies that sort of, you know, it goes back all the way to a film called 13 Women, which is a pre-code film with Myrna Loy. But if you go to the actual, and then obviously things like Peeping Tom and Blood and Black Lace and Psycho. But then if you go into the actual boom, just after things like Black Christmas, you get Halloween. And then you have this whole cavalcade of slasher movies, which were basically very formulaic films that were super popular and were all about young teenagers or 20-somethings getting killed one by one, basically. Body count, Tender Little Indians motif sort of thing. And she argues that when teenage girls go to these films, a lot of these films, they are always sided with the final girl. When teenage boys see the films, they're kind of sided with the killer. But then, by the end of the movie, side up with the final girl. And she did this interesting, really fascinating research. She also said that the biggest spectatorship, and this was researched as well by other scholars, that teenage girls were the biggest audiences of VHS rentals of slasher movies. And the biggest audiences, the reports there with going to the actual cinema during the late 70s, early into the mid 80s, girls would go in groups, good fun night out for the girls, and boys would generally go either on their own or with a date. So it was really interesting to see that kind of stuff. But as far as like spectatorship and watching these things, it's very tricky to sort of decipher. I think it goes back to my point ages ago in the interview, a bit before in the interview, where I talked about people wanting to see themselves on the screen or wanting to see reflections of themselves or having to relate to characters. And I think that's what dictates who they side with. For me, as a kid, I really appreciated the friendships that you got to see between these girls, generally. It was really cool to see these friendships evolve. And then I also loved the style or the look of the killer. I really loved the slasher movies where a girl was a killer, because it was always played out like a whodunit. And the killer herself would always be the lead character as well. Whereas in the male slashers themselves were always like the boogeyman who sort of were in the shadows and never the lead. And then also I liked the creativity of the kills. Like, I just, you know, big, I was a gore hound, still am. So I loved how, you know, these inventive tricks were made, these gags for these people to be killed one by one. So I liked all elements of it. And also the main thing I loved about slasher movies, and still to this day do, and when they detract from formula, it sort of upsets me a little way or unsettles me, is that they were so formulaic. There's something so comforting about something that's going to be so predictable. And I know that sounds weird, but there was a comfort in that. But I think as far as spectatorship, yeah, I think it varies on what people want to see. But yeah, definitely sexuality has a lot to do with what goes on screen, and then also in a reflection of people. If you talk about queer stuff, like queer cinema history, you know, there's a long, long history of the other, or the gay monster, the queer monster. And that you see that in a lot of stuff. There's all those great 50s sci-fi monster movies where the straight couple, you know, beautiful leading lady and handsome man are in, you know, in a romantic union, and then suddenly this creature emerges, right? So it's kind of like, it's a lot of play on a lot of stuff. It could be, you know, paranoia of, STDs, or it could be a paranoia of pregnancy that's unplanned. But a lot of times it's a sexuality thing. It's like a this queer monster has interrupted this, you know, this heterosexual union. If you look at films like AIP's films, How to Make a Monster, that's loaded with queer stuff. It's like an old gay couple making monsters. You know, think of people like James Whale, who brought so much queer sensibility into his Bride of Frankenstein and Frankenstein. And, you know, this long laundry list. Then you think of something like Tennessee Williams with Suddenly Last Summer, and the character of Sebastian, who we don't ever see because he's dead, you know, is this monster, this unnameable, unspeakable monster, who's done all these awful things and is killed like a monster, lynched by the boys that he used to exploit. And, you know, the Katharine Hepburn character is like this mad scientist who's kind of created this Frankensteinian monster. But I love all that, like the whole queer thing with relating to the monster. And that kind of goes all the way through into the 80s, where you have really, like, powerful scripts like Fright Night, by Tom Holland, where you have these really beautiful queer subtexts, where the Stephen Geoffrey's character is this loner. You never understand, you never know his clear sexuality, but there's that great scene where he meets Chris Sarandon, who seduces him. And he breaks down into tears, just Stephen Geoffrey's breaks down into tears. And also that whole wave of in the late 70s and early 80s where there was the monster queer that was very urban, you know, looking for Mr. Goodbar, Tom Berenger, you know, that ending where he kills Diane Keaton when she sort of, you know, laughs at him because he can't get it up, and he's sort of defending his masculinity by killing her. And you have films like Cruising and Windows with the sort of lecherous lesbian, you know, Elizabeth Ashley. You know, all these great movies that I love. They got protested at the time, but I love them. And, so there's a whole laundry list, a long legacy of the queer monster, you know, that sort of changes after the 30s when the queer characters were sort of funny and benign and urbane and you know... But yeah, so that's sort of interesting. So I like that aspect. And I think that's something that a lot of people... I remember I did a big lecture on... It Came from the Closet. And it was all about queer monster stuff. And I had an interview with some guy. And he was like, oh, don't you think it's a negative thing? And I go, well, you know, it's... It's all in perspective. It's, you know, you gotta have a mixed bag of interesting stuff. And a lot of gay people really embrace the idea of the scary monster. You know, not every gay person wants to see, you know, happy gay couple married and having adopted children or whatever. They want to see something more, you know, meaty or nasty or, you know, whatever it is. And I think there needs to be a diversity in representation of characters, and also just telling these great stories. If they're not great stories, that's, you know, a flaw, sure. But it's important to have a whole wide range of stuff. And I think the monster queer is something that I think is important and vitally important in the history of storytelling and film. And I don't know, I think, you know, if you celebrate the wonderful Disney villains, you can also celebrate these great, you know, queer monster villains. And I love what Disney does with the queer villain. You know, like there's that great quote, you know, all women, all... male Disney villains are gay and all women Disney villains are Joan Crawford, you know. So it's this kind of thing there where, you know, the single harpy woman and then the sort of queeny, you know, lascivious gay male, that's what Disney really loves to exploit. You know, if you think of the Gideon and Honest John in Pinocchio or Captain Hook or, you know, Gaston, it goes on. So it's really cool. Scar from Lion King, it's that kind of thing where that's, you know, the lascivious sort of effete, limp-wristed character is always someone to look out for. And I think that's fun. I think it's cool.
You mentioned that for a lot of people, horror films are a date movie. Have they ever served that role for you?
I just feel like I think this, and this sort of goes like full circle to what we were talking about earlier, the thing about film and loving film is it is very solitary. So it's like your thing, right? But then you branch out and you've got all these, you know, your friends and potential partners or whatever who love the same thing. But it's kind of, I've kind of gotten to that point now where I'm kind of comfortable keeping the creative world in one sort of, you know, dimension, and then all the sex and whatever as a second part of my world, or you know, another component. So to merge them is definitely not out of the question. Absolutely not. But to keep them separate is totally cool as well. So
it sounds like you're already in a relationship with film.
Yeah, sure. Let's just say that.
Well, so if people want to check out your work and the books that you've written, where can they find you online?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, I don't really have a site, which is annoying. But if you just, you know, find my name, if you Google my name, you'll find some stuff. So I've written a whole bunch of things. I've done a couple of monographs. I've done a book on the making of Cujo. I've done a book on the making of Christine, so the John Carpenter film. A book on The Howling, the Joe Dante film. I've done a book on the 70s movie musicals. So these are on Amazon, basically, so you can find them all there. I've also done a book on ecological horror movies called Massacred by Mother Nature, Exploring the Natural Horror Film. I am working currently on a book all about the very special episode. So basically, it's a massive book with a whole bunch of excellent writers. You are one of them, who we've all contributed to this book that I'm editing, which is all about the very special episode phenomenon on television sitcoms, where TV shows sort of dealt with dark subject matter or serious subject matter. And there's a whole bunch of stuff in there. And that should be out, hoping to be out next year. There's also a book in the making of Carrie coming out soon as well. I'm hoping for an Easter release next year on that. I do a lot of audio commentaries now, which is really good fun. And it's so much, you know, it's just a joy to do that sort of stuff. And that's for companies like Kino Lorber and Scream Factory and Shout Factory and Arrow and Eureka. Indicator, so all these awesome companies who just do really beautiful work with films. So I do a lot of audio commentary work and liner note writing, so I do a lot of stuff. So yeah, sort of fingers in a lot of pies. Yeah, and then also, yeah, do talks here and there here in Melbourne. And then run, yeah, Film Society. So yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff that I do. So yeah, I guess people can sort of find my work here and there.
Fantastic. Lee, thanks so much for joining me.
Excellent. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Lee for joining me. Our talk about classic film, horror, and finding community got me thinking about two movies you've probably already seen. But my recommendation this week is to spend some time with the Addams Family films from the 1990s. They're not without their flaws, but I love them both as celebrations of classic horror tropes, embellishing a more modern celebration of the unperturbed outsider. To the Addamses, the outside world is hostile and insane. They are gleefully perverse, totally unconcerned about satisfying strangers. And if you ask them whether they're unhappy, they'll sigh with deep satisfaction that yes, they are, completely, and they wouldn't have it any other way. The original Addams Family comics emerged out of the 40s and 50s and stand in contrast to the conservative values of the time. And once you're done watching and rewatching those two films, take a look at another manic response to mid-century morals, Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Here again is a celebration of an absolute weirdo, an incredibly bizarre organism whose strangest trait is that he doesn't mind being strange. It's impossible to imagine Pee-wee immobilized with guilt or shame. Instead, he's eternally delighted by himself, confident and unrestrained, not just a loner and a rebel, a role model. Like the Addams Family, Pee-wee basks in a conservative aesthetic turned upside down. Rules are either inverted or amplified to cartoonish proportions. Whether it's a reaction to religion or tradition or simply one's own neuroses, comedy is the Achilles heel of burdensome rules. To me, that's the appeal of all these films. The more serious the social rules, the more priceless the traditions, the more dire the personal pressures, the more fun it is to watch them all get blown up. Thanks also to everyone who's reviewed The Sewers of Paris on your podcast platform of choice. I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode on Twitter and Facebook. Reach out and let me know your thoughts on the show at sewerspodcast@gmail.com. And a reminder that my live drag comedy show, Queens of Adventure, is doing a ton of shows in March, featuring drag queens playing Dungeons and Dragons. We're at Rebar in Seattle on March 12th, at Emerald City Comic Con on March 13th, at the Siren Theater in Portland on March 18 and 19, and then at Oasis in San Francisco on March 25 and 29. Tickets are now on sale at queensofadventure.com. Hope to see you there. The theme song for the show is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.